Welcome to the Friday Night Clive podcast with me, Clive Payne. In this podcast, we look back at the amazing charities, organisations and people we have chatted to over the past few months, all of whom have interesting and important stories to tell. Are things changing regarding our use of plastics, or are we in denial? Now, we must pay for our plastic bags, of course, and they've increased the cost in some supermarkets now. But does this go far enough to reduce the amount of plastic that we use, or more importantly, the amount of plastic that we throw away? What more can we do to protect our waterways, oceans and communities? Well, of course, these are vital to our biosciences. With me this evening is Charles Hughes, and Charles is an environmental scientist with the Canal and River Trust to tell me what they're doing to keep our waterways clean. Hello, Charles.
Hi, Clive. Hi, all listeners. It's a pleasure to be here this evening.
Thank you very much for your time this evening. Tell me, first of all, about the work of the Canal and River Trust and the work that you do within your department.
Yeah, so the Canal and River Trust is a charity organisation. We are a waterways and wellbeing charity. We're focused on bringing nature to all of the communities in which our canals go through. And me specifically, I work within the Heritage Environment team. We focus on ensuring that we maintain the canal environment, both from a natural perspective and the historic fabric, which is so important to the canals. And my role as an environmental scientist is to ensure that we get rid of things like plastics and focus on tackling things like water pollution, fly tipping. And I also help lead a project tackling invasive species across the West Midlands region.
Give me an example then of what an invasive species is.
So one of the main invasive species in the UK is Japanese knotweed.
Oh, I've heard of that. It's a nightmare.
It's an absolute nightmare, Clive. It's one of those species that it basically, the way that it spreads is by something called its rhizome network, which is the root system, and it only takes very small fragments for it to spread, and once it gets into a new area, it completely colonises it.
Now, if that jumped up at me and offered me a good time, I wouldn't know what it looks like. So describe its foliage to me.
Yeah, so it's it has a very... The leaves are like a shield shape, like a large heart shield shape. But the most distinctive feature of Japanese knotweed is it's almost like a bamboo. It's got a very thick, hollow stem, but it's sort of a reddishy, greeny colour. But if you do see it, typically it can grow into very large stands up to 2 metres high. So it can often be very dense and quite overcrowded.
So what should we do if we see that anywhere?
For Japanese knotweed, always the best thing to do, if you don't know who the landowner is of where it is either contact the local authority, but if you see it on canals, you can contact the Canal and River Trust directly via phone or by the inquiry's email addresses on the website. And most of that information would come actually straight to me. So I would really appreciate if any listeners do spot Japanese knotweed on our canals, please report them, and I will hope to take that on in my project.
Now, here in the Black Country, we're very canal heavy because obviously we've got the canal that comes right through Dudley that comes all the way across from Birmingham and round here. So how many miles of canal have we got in this area approximately?
So in the actual West Midlands, it's over 500 miles of canals, but the BCN network is one of the most densest parts of the canal network. In my sort of the area that I cover around Warsaw, Wolverhampton patch alone is around 70 miles, and that includes a range of different canals such as the Warsaw Canal, Dudley, Stourbridge, Shropshire Union. So there's actually more canals in Birmingham and the West Midlands than there are in Venice, and that's quite a fascinating fact that a lot of people are not aware of, actually.
Yeah, I've heard that, I must admit.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about being plastic-free and look at plastics first of all. Now, why is Plastic Free July important? That's the thing that we're doing this month, isn't it?
Yeah, so Plastic Free July, I know that an Australian organisation actually really sort of set this going, and it's now, I think, reached over 370 million people. But the reason why it's so important is that it's a way of refocusing our attention on plastic, because the issue is obviously a global issue, a very concerning environmental issue, of course. But Plastic Free July actually allows people to see if they can transition their lifestyles from maybe reducing plastic, if they can completely avoid plastic, which is very difficult. That is a great thing, but it's actually looking at ways that we can change our consumer lifestyle, but also lobby against companies about how they're actually producing and manufacturing products as well. I think it's very important.
I think it's difficult though, as you allude to. I mean, you look in this studio, for example, we are surrounded by plastic on our computer screens, across the desk, our keyboard, our microphones, our infrastructure, our walls, all the cabling that goes everywhere, it's difficult to not use it.
It's extremely difficult. It's the same, funny enough as well, when we talk about plastic, we can also talk about a human's addiction to oil, because obviously the majority of plastics are produced from hydrocarbons and crude oil. And it's one of those things that, as you say, it's used in every single industry, and most of what we see around us when we go into supermarkets predominantly is produced by plastic. So that's where the issue is very difficult, because plastic in itself it can be a very durable and useful material. It's quite lightweight as well, so it's good for transport, but it's the persistence of plastic. So looking at alternatives is one thing, but I think it's similar with oil that we have. It's so ingrained into our society and the way that we produce goods that it's something that's very challenging to address.
How do we reduce, then, the hundreds of millions of tons of plastic that are produced each year? Because a lot of it can't be recycled. Now, I'm talking about you and I, the humble person in the street, for example.
Yeah.
You know, I try and buy my fruit and veg loose because I don't get why supermarkets use plastic.
Yes, I know.
I really don't get it. Because when I was little, you went to the greengrocers and everything was tipped in your mum's shopping bag thing. You know, cabbage, potatoes, the lot. You didn't need plastic.
Yes.
Exactly. So I think a lot of it is down to our behaviour. Supermarkets aren't using plastic bags now. What other things do you think that we can do?
I think, firstly, I think we almost have to audit our own lifestyle, I guess, and audit the way that we generate waste. I think that's an important thing that I've done it, like, personally from my own perspective, is look at how much of the products that I actually use, are there alternatives to plastic with the products that my typical consumables, whether it be toothpaste or my toothbrush, which is one thing that I have actually changed a couple of months back. I've got a bamboo toothbrush now, and I've completely got rid of using plastic toothbrushes. But I think it's a way of looking at what we are doing on that sort of local level, the way that we're consuming certain products. But also, I think the important thing is that the one fact that is going to really drive change is that if we change the way that we consume plastic, if we can go to plastic-free alternatives when they're available, I think that almost drives the market economy to look towards alternatives, because the way that the consumer demands change really does determine where business is going to move to in the future. And that's happened, a prime example, with renewable energy, from what you'd see as conventional fossil fuel companies of moving heavily into solar and other renewables. So I think it's definitely from the consumer perspective, but we can't avoid the fact that manufacturing and packaging, which packaging plays a huge role, it's over half of plastic waste, especially in the UK, is from plastic packaging. So we really need to lobby government as well to say, look, that we need to force companies to look to alternatives, or in other ways, if they can't completely reduce plastic, at least reduce the volume of plastic that's being used in products as well. I think that's another key area.
Now, the worrying thing is a lot of our plastics end up in our canals and rivers. I mean, how do you monitor to that, and what steps can you take if you believe that there's plastic infiltration?
Yeah, so we, back in 2018, 2019, we actually did a study with Coventry University where we looked at 20 key areas across the network. These are specific areas where canals were either linked with a river or they directly outletted into the seas, either the North Sea, the Irish Sea, etc. And from that sample, so we had walkover surveys to look at actual presence of plastic along 100 metre sections. Coventry Canal was a really good example of this. And then we recorded the different items, whether it be plastic or other litter items. But then we basically did this across those locations and got sort of average figures and average data and extrapolated that over the 2,000-mile network that we have. So it was a very snapshot sample, but that the results that came back from that was, when we extrapolated the data across the whole network, was that we were estimating that there was around 24 million pieces of litter, and about 59% of that, 14 million pieces, were predominantly plastics, whether that be food wrappers, plastic bottles, etc., etc. So this was a really staggering fact, because we have got a number of areas where we've got outlets to major rivers and seas, and across those areas, from based on our sampling for that one specific survey snapshot over a period of time, we estimate that there's around 500,000 potential items of plastic going out to major rivers, which ultimately fed the sea. So That, from our perspective, was a big wake-up call. But in response to that as well, what we've done now, that we have operational teams covering a huge, vast area of the network. So within the West Midlands, we'll have operational teams, for example, Warsaw and Wolverhampton. And the operatives, in some areas, sadly, are spending 3 to 4 days a week alongside all their other roles, just literally clearing litter and clearing rubbish from our canals. And the report that I actually cited earlier on didn't take into account plastics and other items, which was on the land adjacent to our canals, which ultimately, sadly, ends up on the canal. So they're typically underestimates the figures that we provide. But the one thing that's really important that we're really pushing is our Plastics Challenge campaign, where we basically encourage people, our users who use the canals, to, if they can, to help remove litter from them. Because ultimately, the vast majority of people who use the canals are really conscious about the environment. And by all of us removing litter items, we could literally clear our canals from this terrible scourge of plastic pollution.
So I guess then the greater proportion of this is coming from our behaviour through discarded litter. How much plastic comes through the water infrastructure, say through stormwater, or, you know, that gets flushed down toilets, drains, things like that?
Yeah, so for canals, it's obviously slightly different. So the drainage system, obviously we have surface water outfalls where only fresh water can be discharged in the canals. We do have combined sewers as well, where sometimes water companies can discharge into canals, but that's very, very rare now. But it's very difficult to give an estimate of the surface water loading, because a lot of the plastics that are coming through discharges tend to be on the microplastic form, so a range much lower. So it's very difficult to quantify that within the water samples themselves. But what we can do is actually look at the silt samples. This is the sediments and the organic material at the bottom of canals. So we can sample that for the microplastic proportion, which is predominantly come from either breakdown of primary plastic litter, or it's coming from that sort of discharge water infrastructure passage as well. So we did a study around 15 sites across our network. As Birmingham as an example, one sample, a kilogram worth of sediment sample from a Birmingham canal in the Birmingham city centre, had 588 different microplastics in it. And this was 200, yeah, it's unbelievable. And it was approximately 280 fibres, and there was also microbeads and some other unique plastic fibres as well. But and that was just from one sample. In other areas where we have a lot more discharges and sort of major litter hotspots, we call them, that figure can jump up into the thousands, sadly. So that can give us a snapshot, but from from a routine perspective, you'd have to do a lot of water quality sampling across a huge network. But this is things that we are exploring, and we have begun new water quality projects, and microplastics will be probably at some point coming back onto that focus. But it's absolutely staggering when you look at the sort of the nanoparticle and the microplastic particle form. It's really concerning.
I remember watching something on television probably a couple of years ago, and they were talking about these cosmetic facial scrubs that you can get. And I was using one at the time, and I looked at the actual composition of the facial scrub, and it was little micro bits of plastic. So I thought, so I'm washing my face in this stuff,
yes,
and then it's going down the waste pipe in the shower kind of thing. Well, that you can't do that. Now, you can get them on the market that don't have microplastics, but it's important, for example, to look at the label, and it will tell you what it's made of. And I think the sensible thing is to use something that's biodegradable.
Yeah, Clive, I completely agree. I think that was the another thing that the previous EU legislation tried to drive behind as well with packaging is correct labelling as well, because a lot of the time, people buy products, you can tell obviously usually from the actual the container or what you buy or the tube that you buy that it tends to be plastic, sadly. But it's the, like you said, it's the constituents within the product, whether it's a certain substance or a cream, like you said, a cosmetic or a washing, even shampoos as well. And sometimes even from the labels, it can be actually quite difficult to discern whether there is plastic. Sometimes there'll be certain chemical compounds in there that might be the constituents of certain plastics, but people might not necessarily know that that is associated with plastic, like polyethylene and stuff like that. So it's always useful. You can find tons of material online, and there is actually some really good alternatives out there for things like face creams, and organic toothpaste is another big one as well, because a lot of toothpastes actually contain plastic. And one that is sadly a blight on many of our streets in the UK is chewing gum, and chewing gum predominantly is from plastic compounds as well. So there's a number of different products, but I think the seeking of alternatives now, I think a lot of people are driving home that they want to get more organic produce and organic products. And, you know, there is a lot of different websites and companies that are moving towards that. But, you know, it's I guess, not at the fastest pace that we would like, considering the global crisis of plastic. Mm-hmm. But there are more alternatives. And, you know, moving on from previous years, I think some companies are doing a lot better than others.
So what can you do then when plastic gets into your waterways? Is it just simply dredging the canal? Because I guess if you dredge it, you're only going to get, as you said, sediment. You're not going to get all those sort of, you know, nanoparticles. What can you do? And what legal powers do you have as well?
Yeah, so as a navigation authority, obviously we have a huge boating community. If some of your listeners are listening who are boaters, we have a great relationship, my team, actually, with a number of boaters in our local area. But dredging is obviously predominantly done for navigational purposes, but we do obviously remove a lot of fly tip material that's been within the channel and other waste items. But the actual key one, the key process, is that we have very, very regular litter picks done by our operational teams. But we've had over 100,000 hours of volunteer hours, and with the majority of that going to litter picking and waste clearances by our volunteers. Completely free, you know, complete free service, because people care about their canals. And the most important part is that you've got a combination of floating litter, which is on the actual water itself, which can be removed via using boats, from using nets or different other abstraction equipment. But stuff at the bottom, as you say, is typically dredging, but we only dredge certain areas depending on the navigational need for it. So there could be areas where there is lots of plastic that might not necessarily be affecting navigation, but over time, you know, we will aim to remove that, because it will ultimately affect navigation. But you know, the big problem for us is the fact that a lot of the litter and the plastic is actually coming on from buildings and businesses and landowners adjacent to us. So it's actually going out to businesses and communities and engaging with them at the source, rather than waiting for the plastic to arrive. But the operational team in Warsaw and Wolverhampton, just between January and April alone, spent £55,000 just on clearing fly tipping on three canals, the Warsaw Canal, the Worley-Nessington and the Rushall Canal. And that was just for fly tipping. That doesn't include all the litter that's regularly cleared by volunteers and operational teams. So it's having people on the ground, but the real way that you can tackle this is really engaging with the source issues, whether it be certain communities or certain businesses, etc., etc.
One thing we haven't talked about is the detrimental effect this has on our wildlife, of course, because we all saw The Blue Planet some years ago, where with David Attenborough on the television. There was a scene where they were watching, I can't remember what animal it was now, trying to feed one of its young a piece of plastic, and you're screaming at the television going no, you know. Yeah. But this is what's upsetting our ecosystem and our biodiversity, because it's detrimental to our birds and, you know, other animals that live on and near canals, and, you know, and our insects too.
Yeah, the ecological impacts are absolutely huge. I mean, I know people like to talk about the fact that, you know, humans are consuming plastic in some regard because of the fact that it moves up the ecosystem as fish and seabirds, etc., eat these, and we ultimately eat a lot of different types of species from the oceans. But the problem is that we actually have species that are actually starving to death because of the fact that their digestive tract has been blocked by items of plastic, or we have seals on even around the UK coastline that are being trapped within plastic that are consumable, such as, you know, even having beer cans with the plastic rings. It's something so simple can have such detrimental impacts on specific species. But from the canal perspective as well, during the nesting season, the bird nesting season, predominantly over the summer period, we've got birds that nest both within the canal and along land adjacent to that. But sadly, in many examples, plastic is actually becoming part of that habitat now as well, which is very concerning. And not only have you got the choking associated with ingestion from species, but it's actually smothering habitats and disturbing things like macroinvertebrates or plant species within aquatic environments as well. So it's that perspective. But the one that is least spoken about is the fact that plastics are made predominantly from hydrocarbons and certain chemical compounds that can be very ecotoxic as well. So the actual disposal of plastics within water environments, especially, plastics are very good at absorbing chemical contaminants, number one. So they pick up contaminants from their environment, and when they move, they're spreading those chemicals. Mm-hmm. But also, over time, those materials are breaking down, sometimes over hundreds of years, and they will re-release some of those chemical compounds that the actual what they're actually made of. So it could be hydrocarbons, or things like vinyl chloride, and some really dangerous chemicals. So we have to be conscious of the fact that plastic pollution also equates to chemical pollution as well. It's not just physical.
Where do we go from here then?
Well, this is the important question, I guess. It's a very difficult issue to sort of address. But I think the main way that we can do it is, number one, is it will always be education. And I think Blue Planet did a great way where it really sort of opened up an awareness, especially across the whole globe, such an important program, where people actually were being more conscious about the way that they dispose of plastics as well. And I think I would say to our listeners, a lot of plastics, there's different classes of plastics. There's around 7 or 8 usually grouped under these RIC codes. So when you look at your plastic bottle or plastic item, there'll be the infamous recycling triangle with a number in it. Mm-hmm. And typically the lower number, so the 1s and 2s, they're usually the plastics that are the most easily recyclable. This is usually to do with the fact that the process of the manufacture of that type of plastic, so it's actually easy to remelt it and then repurpose it. But then there are plastics that are almost impossible to recycle. So it's being conscious of the labeling schemes of the different products for when we dispose of it, ensuring that we can try to look at products where we can potentially reduce the amount of plastic that we are consuming from our perspective. But I would say really that we need to look at government and speak to government and communities all across the UK, especially not just areas where there isn't where there is issues, non-hotspot areas as well, and address this from, you know, a financial perspective. Mm-hmm. I think the plastic packaging tax, which is planned to come into force on April 2022, is looking at taxing plastic packaging on imports coming into the country, but also manufacturing within the country as well. So it's a flat rate tax. The details are not, I don't believe, completely finalised, but there's like a £200 flat rate tax on per tonne for manufacturing companies or on imports from other companies above 10 tonnes, so it doesn't disproportionately affect those who produce a much smaller amount. But mm-hmm. it doesn't sound like a lot of money, and in the grand schemes potentially it's not, but over, you know, across all these different companies, it can rack up into hundreds of millions, billions of pounds. So I think there has to be financial measures put on this, but we don't want to obviously disproportionately affect small businesses or, you know, the consumer, because the consumer's been paying its way for a lot of these issues for these different companies in terms of disposal and within the price of products and things like that as well. So I think there has to be government action. We need to look at as well funding for innovation. You know, I'm an environmental scientist, and I know there's a huge amount of environmental issues across the globe, but we have to look at opportunities to look at alternatives. And the industry, the plastics industry as well, there is different action plans that have been suggested, and there has been funding by the government as well to look at alternatives to plastic for things like packaging. So I think the situation is very bad, but we have to accept that and look for alternatives moving forward and really lobby government to take strong action.
Tell me then, finally, what campaigns the Canal and River Trust have got going this year then?
Yes, so we launched a Plastics Challenge campaign, which is basically the statistics that I sort of alluded to earlier on. Basically, it was part of the research from Coventry University. And we realised that although there's 14 million items of plastic that is being dropped on our waterways, whether it's blown in or purposely discarded there, we said that actually we've got such a high usage of our canals. They're the most accessible waterways across the country, more so than rivers, because obviously you have private land. But they're so accessible. We have millions and millions of visitors every year. If for every time somebody visited, if they removed an item of litter, we could potentially go completely plastic free for all of our waterways. Now, obviously, plastic and litter is coming at different times, but we really urge people, if you are using your waterway, if you can spare, 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. Sometimes I'm out on the waterways for hours doing this, but if you can spare time to remove litter from the waterways, it makes local action makes such big global impact. And we've got some absolutely amazing volunteers who have taken up the plastic challenge. They've pledged their support to the trust, and they're out there sometimes on a daily basis removing litter and plastic, giving us a huge hand. And the trust is spending about £1 million a year just dealing with this issue alone. So we're trying everything that we can, but communities, make such a big impact on keeping our waterways clean, and we really appreciate all the support under the Plastics Challenge campaign.
Where can we find out more information about the Canal and River Trust?
So if you go onto our website, www.canalrivertrust.org.uk, or you can search us on Google as well, you'll find our website. And if you want to specifically look at the Plastics Challenge or the plastic statistics, etc., that I have alluded to today, you just type in Plastics on Canals in Google. It will take you to a web page, and you can also pledge your support and sign a support declaration for tackling plastic on our waterways.
And that would be a good project for schools to do, I would have thought.
Absolutely, yes. We've got community engagement officers and a school program where we go into schools to educate them about issues on waterways, whether it be chemical pollution or plastics. And one thing that you can do, which I'll mention now, you can join one of our volunteer groups or community groups. We have towpath task forces where they basically communities adopt sections of canal, and they actually maintain them and do litter picking, or they help with vegetation management. And it's a really, really good way to get involved with the trust. So you can also visit the volunteering pages on our website, and it will give you all the information if you would like to join.
Charles Hughes from the Canal and River Trust, thank you very much for talking to Friday Night Clive. That is your lot for this episode. You can catch the programme live every Friday night on Black Country Radio from 8 p.m. If you like our podcast, please subscribe by heading to blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcast or wherever you get your podcast from. See you very soon. This is a Black Country Radio podcast presented by Clive Payne and produced by Andy Caddick.